Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Celtic Now and for our podcast. My name is Ryan Clifford. Joining me in the podcast this week, once again, is co-host Robert Boyle. Robert, how's things, mate?
All good, Ryan, thanks.
And obviously, we've got a guest on the podcast this week, Olympian, Commonwealth Game, Athletics, Hammer Thrower, British Champion, Chris Bennett. Chris, how's things, mate?
Very good, mate. It might be the first time I've ever had the Union Jack on a Celtic podcast, but we'll go with it. We'll go with that one.
I think it's a wee exception, mate. She's a good guy in that, so we'll be all right. Obviously, Chris, it's a bit of a tough period at the moment, obviously with the pandemic and obviously yourself with athletics and stuff. How's lockdown impacted your training regime and your events and getting facilities to train and keep yourself fit?
So I think it's quite ironic that we're recording this a year since we actually went into lockdown. So a year has been a really long time for me in sport. This time last year, I didn't really know what I was doing, what was happening, where I was really getting money from as well, because like I'm usually in schools doing sessions, doing school visits, paid quite well for it, and I was told I was not getting any more work. I couldn't get into schools, they couldn't pay me what I owe me, so I ended up taking a full-time job with Tesco. So I was delivering shopping for Tesco for 3 months. Other supermarkets are available if you want to go down that route as well. But so it was kind of tricky for me. And then I did that for three months full time. Was kind of falling out of love with the sport, so decided I was going to go back into full time training. So went part time with them, and then ever since September I've been back in full time training, and I've not missed a day's training. So we've been fortunate enough that we're granted elite athlete status under the government rules. So my gym's still been open. I've got a set of keys to the place I train. I've still been able to throw. Yeah, I've not really had any changes to my training at the minute. There's obviously a lot less access to physio and different services like that, but it's been quite refreshing because it makes you find out what you actually need in training. So it's been good. And I've started competing already. Had a good start to the season, so I've got quite a few comps coming up. Because we're in that elite status, we kind of know what's going on. We can travel freely. We get tested twice a weekly. We've got to submit those results. So yeah, it's good. I'm quite hopeful for the summer, whereas this time last year I didn't really kind of know what was going on. So yeah, it's quite exciting times.
It's quite refreshing to hear that you're still able to kind of live a life in a way, that you're still competing at the sport you love. And ideally as well, you're keeping yourself healthy and your mind healthy by keeping yourself busy during this pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, it's lockdown's probably been one of the best things that happened to me, because it gave me a real idea of what I wanted to do in the sport, and I had to make choices about what I needed and what I didn't need. It was good because I've learned to face problems kind of face on, because previously I buried my head in the sand, where it's just a case of, do you know what, you've got no money coming in, you need to survive, get a job, and it takes you into the big real bad world and what you've got to actually do to survive. And you see the other side of the coin, and I looked at it and I go, so I'm actually in quite a privileged position. I had a job at the time, I could still exercise, I could still move pretty freely, and got out and got my daily exercise. So it made me thankful for the things that I had, to then be able to go back into full-time training and still use the gym. And I mean, I don't see it as, it is a privilege for me, but it's, at the end of the day, it's my job. So I'm still getting to do the job that I love. I'm still getting to do the sport that I love without any interference. And I'm quite thankful for that at the minute.
it's actually quite refreshing, as I say, Robert, that it's, I know a few others are having a bad time at the moment, but it's good to hear that somebody's actually having a bit of success, no just all doom and gloom, and it's good to see Chris still thriving under the conditions at the moment.
What I really impressed with Chris there was what he was saying is he didn't get to train and he couldn't earn money. And just refreshing to hear a guy, an athlete, which had so many highs and been at so many tournaments, that didn't think, no sign this in a bad way, Chris, but above himself to go, I better get out there and make a living. And just a humble guy would go and do a job in Tesco, because I think sometimes you get people that think they're above that status in life. And I don't mean that in a bad way, Chris. I just mean it's cool to hear that.
It's like, do you know, at the end of the day, I am very fortunate to have been in a position where I've been able to train full-time for the past 7-8 years. Now, that's a privilege for me, and I often think elite sportsmen take that for granted and they see it as a God-given right, and it's not. It's, I have, fortunate enough that I have had people who have been kind to me with their employment, have given me opportunities to go and earn money on the side while still doing my sport. Another, I think often you see that, and especially footballers and rugby players, that's gone from their perspective. They just see themselves as, oh, do you know what, someone should pay me to do this. The world owes you nothing at the end of the day. Like, the sport owes me nothing. It owes me nothing. So it's my job, if I can't do what I have to just put my big boy pants on and just face up to it. Like, it will come back. But there's no point in sitting moaning on the couch or moaning to other people about it, because it ain't going to change anything. And that's the hard fact of it. No one else is going to do these things for me. So I had to do it for myself. And I remember going into my boss at Tesco, and I put my CV in, and she phoned me back 20 minutes later. She's like, can you come in for an interview? I said, yeah, no worries at all. So sat down and she said, so what do you do? Are you a taxi driver, bus driver? You know, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a full-time athlete. And she's like, all right. And she just kind of looked at me and just said, yeah, cool. And I don't think it really hit home to her until I did some stuff on the radio, and I said I'd been working like 45, 47 hours that week. She says, oh, you are really as good as you are at sport. I said, yeah, I'm not going to bullshit you. I'm not going to come in and say, I'm something I'm not. This is what I am, and I'm Olympian, and I've earned that right. But at the time, I needed that job. And that's what I had to do for 3 months. I mean, I was fortunate that I got to go part-time with that, and I've still worked part-time for them. I still do 5 nights a week, so I still train during the day. Like, Monday, Tuesday, my day's off, so I do my double days on there, and then on a Wednesday, Friday, and a Saturday, I train maybe like 11:30 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then I come home, get some food, and go straight to work and deliver people shopping between 7 and 11, and that's just what I had to do to survive. And it's about surviving and about being able to still train. I was fortunate I could still do that, but I just had to do it. You know what I mean? And there's people, I mean, there's people dying, there's people losing their jobs, and I was fortunate enough I had a job, I could exercise, I could do a sport I love. So who am I to moan about it? I'm very privileged. I'm very, very privileged, you know, and I would never ever take that for granted. I was quite fortunate with that. So, yeah, it was good for me.
Like, you see, in a way as well, you've kind of used your head in a way, go, right, I can't do my training, I need to get a job quick, and you've acted quickly. But some people might, because of the situation, they went, my job will come back, I'll just dilly-dally, I'll see if it's there. But I think these days, more people are starting to be like yourself and going, no, I need to go there, I need to work, I need to provide, I need to put food on the table, I need to survive. And I think as well, with yourself being an athlete as well, you can still train. It's maybe keeping you mentally fine and ticking, because you can go out and think, right, up, routine, job, training. You're keeping yourself busy all the time.
Well, that was the first thing with me. For the first couple of weeks of the pandemic, no one really knew what was going on. We had pubs shut, we had clubs shut, we had businesses shut. So everyone's just kind of like, am I going to have a job? Am I going to have this? So you find yourself sitting binge-watching TV series, and sitting watching TV, and you're up till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, not really doing anything. Facilities are closed, so you can't train. You're like, well, what am I really doing here? So I had to get a routine right away. So I went to Tesco and I said, I need a job. They gave me a job, and they said, oh, do you want to know what the shifts are? I was like, no, because I want a routine. So I knew what days I was working. I was working 10-hour shifts on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I knew I couldn't train those days. I had a Friday back shift, a Saturday off, Sunday back shift, Monday off. So I knew I could train Friday, Saturday, Monday. And then eventually, I actually stopped training on the Friday, and I was just doing Saturday, Monday. So I was training twice a week, but they still gave me that routine. I could still keep my hand in it. But at the time, I was probably way out of shape. I was overweight, and I was kind of losing my way with the sport. So lockdown gave me that focus and that routine that I seen what normal life is, and I don't, and I wouldn't ever consider being an elite athlete as a normal life, because we get to go different countries, we get to do something we love, and you know, things like that. So I seen what normal life was like, and I was like, I do not want to be stuck in a job where I have this routine and I can't train. So that was the point. I went, you know what, I still want to do the sport. Okay, what I need to do, I need to drop hours in Tesco. They were fortunate enough to me. I said to them, I want to go part-time. They said, cool, when do you want to go part-time? I was like, as soon as possible. They're like, okay, start part-time next week. So I was fortunate that they still valued me as an employee to be able to do that. And if the Olympics had happened last year, would I have qualified? Probably not, because I was overweight and I was a fat shit. Let's not be about the bush here. I was 24 and a half stone, strong as an ox, but I couldn't move. So it gave me that focus to lose the weight, get back into shape, and give me that extra year to prepare for it. So it's making the best of what you've got. And you see people and athletes moaning, and they always want something to do it for them, someone else to do it for them, or someone else to hand it to them on the plate. It's like, well, no, what else? What have you done to make it happen? What have you done to make like, so it's like the thing with the footballers were off for like 2-3 months, and they're all moaning about coming back into pre-season. It's like, well, what have you done during that 2-3 months off? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? What have you done to do it? And it's about taking ownership and taking self-responsibility of it. May not be your fault, but it's your responsibility. Something I use a lot. So the thing I've likened to Celtic this year is COVID is not their fault. Going to Dubai and Julian getting COVID is not their fault, but it's their responsibility to take action from it. It's their responsibility to deal with it at the end of the day, and they haven't dealt with it properly.
It's refreshing, Chris, just to hear your side of the story on how you used COVID to focus again and get yourself back into sports, and the determination really to look at yourself and get back into how you could change things and make things right. And I don't know if it's just in football, but a lot of people come back, no mention names, overweight, no focused. And I think it's refreshing to hear for an athlete that you had the opposite for certain people.
Yeah.
Probably in a football game.
I mean, I think we know the footballer you're talking about, and this footballer broke lockdown rules and had parties at his house, and it's always poor me, poor me, poor me. It's like, well, it ain't your fault, but it's your responsibility. Now, I haven't always been like this. I was very much like this until 2018. I had a massive mental breakdown after Commonwealth Games, kind of fell out of love with the sport. And yeah, I was playing at it. I was deciding if it was for me. I was eating and drinking what I wanted. I was still training. I was probably kidding myself on quite a bit. But at the end of the day, I look back and that's 2 years wasted of my career. So I would like to think when that individual sits down, they can look back and go, do you know what? I could have been, is playing for Celtic as good as I could be? Now, as a fan, you always want to play for Celtic, but I have no problems with someone wanting a bit. So, like, for instance, I'll give you an example. Kieran Tierney. Kieran Tierney's been called the biggest rat since Brendan Rodgers to leave Celtic. Kieran Tierney, I have no problem with Kieran Tierney leaving. He wants to better himself. He's got life-changing money. He's playing in a better league against better players, and he's thriving under it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. There can be no room for sentiment in an elite sport, because you want to be the best that you can be. Is that individual and are the footballers at Celtic trying to be the best that they can be? Not in my eyes.
No, it's definitely something I think it's refreshing here, Chris, because obviously at Celtic, things have happened this season. Players have maybe not come back in certain fitness. But obviously, because you class yourself obviously as an elite athlete, and your mind is always set to be fit, to eat better, to train harder, perform harder. But obviously, you mentioned that mentally you had a wee bit of a kind of breakdown, and that maybe, and then when you can back out that, you realise like maybe how lucky and how determined you are to keep kicking on and keep doing well in the sport.
Correct. And I think the big difference between me and footballers and other athletes and footballers is we don't have money. We don't get paid the massive money that they do. Now, Celtic footballers who turn up week in, week out, if they win, lose or draw, they are still paid their 10, 15, 20 grand a week. So do they really care as footballers whether they get success or not? I don't know. I can't speak for them.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak for them, but they're still getting their money every week. So we as fans are not as... footballers don't appreciate what we go through as fans. But at the end of the day, it goes back to that thing. It's not your fault. It's your responsibility to sit up and take action. And that goes from everyone at the football club to take ownership of their own thing, you know. And I'll speak about it a little bit later on. I had no problems with them going to Dubai, but I had a problem with what they were doing in Dubai. You know what I mean? As a sportsman, I can see why you would want to go away and train in better environments, and why you would want to go away and go and use a winning formula. Because I'll speak about it now. But you look at it and you go, every year under Brendan Rodgers, we went to Dubai and we kicked on. That was the model for success. So as an athlete, you want to keep that routine. You go away, you get the break, you get the refresh, you come back and you kick on. The first day you're sitting and you've got a manager there who speaks about he needs a change of mentality, speaks about how players don't want to be there, speaks about creating a different environment. The first thing you do is you give athletes a day off to sit by the pool and drink beers. What does that say about the mentality?
See, because it's probably different, because obviously I played football myself and Robert played football, but when you're an elite athlete like yourself, you kind of do think different about sport and exercise. And you see, for us fans, we're just seeing it morally, but when you're in your sport and as well in that kind of bubble as a people in the limelight, you see it from the sports side of it and the mentality side of it, and you know it's wrong. If he's come out and saying that, surely him, John Kennedy, or whoever else, the board, whatever, they're the ones who go to change the mentality. The players can change it, but you need to implement the changes.
Correct. So there is one person at the top who dictates the mentality, dictates the drive, and that is the manager. He is the man at the top, and he dictates everything. So to me, I look back at it, and if I go, right, I've got a training camp, and I'm going to, let's say, Tenerife, because I was meant to go to Tenerife in January, I would have still went had it not been cancelled by the Spanish government. That was the only reason I didn't go. So I didn't have any qualms about going away and travelling and doing this. But so he's given them a day off on the first day of the training camp. Fair enough, they travelled, but we've just been pumped off our rivals. Now, we've just lost the league, effectively. We were, 13 or 15 points behind the league. The first thing you do is you give them a day off in Dubai by the pool, and you've got people sitting in a jacuzzi, in a hot tub, having pints, eating what they wanted. So there's people dying at home. And that's not even coming to the question yet, because we're still questioning the mentality as a sportsman. If I did that, I would be crucified by my coach. I would absolutely be crucified. I'd be crucified by the governing body that are paying for me to go there.
You might not even be a hammerful anymore. You might be totally.
Exactly. Like, completely. Like, I don't get it, man. I don't get it. So I think the board should have acted quicker and got rid of him. Like, I wanted rid of them after the first Rangers game.
Mm-hmm.
And they stuck with them. Now, why they stuck with them, I don't know. But it's done now. And 10 in a row is gone. But it's part of life. You've just got to go on with it.
But as I say, we've all gone to Celtic a bit more. But back to get onto yourself, Chris. Early days when you were younger, growing up, was athletics always in your mind, or was... was it, as like most of us young guys at the time, football, Celtic, was that... did you ever play football, or was athletics your main thing?
I'm not going to lie, I was the fat kid in school. I wasn't really athletic. Mm-hmm. I wasn't... I was quite sporty, though. I had a really pushy mum who just wanted me to do everything. So I did, like, football, tennis, trampoline and rugby. I did everything at school, and my first experience of sport, like playing competitively, was playing for the school team. And I played in goals because I wasn't a very good outside. I could kind of move about in goals. I was bigger than everyone else. I wasn't afraid. I would slide at people's feet, and that was my first experience of competitive sport. But then I actually went into rugby for 4 years, and I come for a council house in Blardardy, just no far from Drumchapel. My dad was on incapacity benefits. My mum worked 3 jobs to keep me in sport. So we didn't come from a well-off background. I still live in a council house, and I'm not afraid to say it. Like, I'm very proud of where I came from. I'm very proud of my roots. I didn't fit in the demographic of rugby. Rugby is a very private school, very money-orientated sport. And coming for the background, I didn't fit in at all. Mm-hmm. I didn't fit in at all. So my mate did athletics, and he said, how do you fancy coming down? And it was just around the time of the Manchester Commonwealth Games in 2002, and we did laps of the track, and I fucking hated it, man. I was blown at my arse as I was going on the track. I couldn't run the length of myself. I said to my mum, I'm not coming back. So she's like, no, you're going back. So I tried shot put, was okay at it. Tried discus, javelin, wasn't very good at it. I tried hammer, but I absolutely loved it at the time. and I fitted into athletics because most of the people that did athletics were all the wee bams, and I fitted in with that, and that's how I enjoyed it as well. So I started getting more and more into my athletics, kind of trained two nights a week, was getting medals at sport and county level and kind of national level. And then I got to the age of 19 and I kind of been training two, three nights a week, kind of realised that I had something for the sport. But as you get to 19, you discover new things, you discover women, you discover drinking, you discover all these different things. And I took a 4-week hiatus for the sport, and I was kind of like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. And I remember I went to Cardiff for my 20th birthday on a pure random night out. I don't know why I went to Cardiff, probably chasing women, that sort of thing. So, but it was like 3 years went down to Cardiff, and then I'd taken 4 weeks off the sport. My coach was like, what are you doing? You could have, this was just before Delhi Commonwealth Games, and he's like, you could go to Delhi Commonwealth Games and you're just sitting, pissing it all away. And that really hit home, and I got to stage. I missed out in Delhi by a metre and a half, but the qualification for Glasgow opened up a couple of years after it. And I was like, do you know what? I'm going to get to Glasgow Commonwealth Games. So I'd qualified for Glasgow in 2012 and had a kind of tough year in 2012. My dad was dying, and we didn't really know at the time. He died in the August, and I was injured that year. So I kind of didn't really know what I was doing with the sport, whether I wanted to do it. And then I kind of had 3-4 months off, and it was just on nights out, just doing the usual group. Bevying and not really caring what you were doing for sport. But I got back into sport, and I was like, put myself into some really good shape. And then I lost my coach in the April of the 2013. So like that's like 9 months I've lost two of the most influential people in my life. So decided I was going to Glasgow and I was going to win a medal and I was going to put all my wrongs right. And I imagined winning Glasgow before I'd even done the competition, and I was out my arse after the final. I finished dead last. And I left the stadium that night and I was in floods of tears. And like, it was an amazing experience of being in Glasgow, and you got so many people watching you, and kind of like, it was my first kind of big competition with social. You do it in your home city, social media blows up, everybody wants a party, everybody wants you to do something like that, and like people message you for tickets and whatnot, and it was just overwhelming. Like, and I decided that I was never going to feel like that ever again in sport, so used it to my advantage. Eventually qualified for 2016 Olympics. So I've got the Doug kind of underneath the table sniffing for something, so if the camera starts moving, it's just my Doug. So they spent the whole year in 2016 telling me I wasn't going to the Olympics, and I was fine with that. Like, I was okay. I was like, cool, I'm not going to go to the Olympics. And then they told me 3 weeks beforehand I was going to Rio, and I was like, oh fuck, I need to change my plans here. I need to completely change what I'm doing. So yeah, and I'd suffered in sport from overachieving. Mm-hmm. I'd achieved everything I wanted in sport and more, and that was it. I was playing at it for 2-3 years, and the big thing for Gold Coast was always I was going to go there and I was going to right my wrong and I was going to win a medal, and I was in the shape of my life. And I thought immediately, the first thing I thought was like, I can't do what I did in Glasgow. And immediately when you think don't do something, you automatically do it. Mm-hmm. So it was hard for me. It was really hard. And I had a massive mental breakdown after it, and really, really struggled with my mental health and whatnot. And like I said, I kind of fell out of love with the sport for a couple of years, and didn't really know where I was going to go. So it was tough. But now I find myself sitting here after a lockdown of the year, after lockdown, it's been great. You know, I enjoy myself. I enjoy my own. I'm comfortable with who I am as a person, and I'm comfortable with what I do in sport. So it's been a kind of whirlwind 31 years of my life, but I'm not done with the sport yet. And I fear the day that I've got to go out into the big bad world and get a real life job, because I'm loving life at the minute.
Because again, Chris, sorry to hear about your dad passing away and your coach, Katz. As especially in normal life, it's hard. But see, when you're an athlete and having to deal with that and train and go for Olympics and Commonwealth Games, it must be really hard to keep yourself focused. And as you say, no go away from the sport completely, because you see it in football terms when guys get released or something happens when they're younger, they just give up football and they don't go back. So for yourself to continue to power on and actually think, you know what, I'm going to, maybe in your head you're thinking, I'm going to make my dad proud, make my old coach proud, I'm going to make myself proud, and just continue to plod away and keep yourself, basically keep going and keep striving for better things. I think it's really, really, it maybe shows you maybe how mentally strong you are. Maybe you don't maybe think you are, but it shows you maybe how mentally strong you are, because you're keeping going and you're in the back of your mind, you're going, right, I'm going to do for dad, I'm going to do for him. You keep thinking, and that's maybe keeping you going as well as loving the sport, but it's pushing you on and pushing you on all the time.
one of the big things that I didn't do, and I do now, is face problems head on. So I didn't grieve for my dad, and I didn't really grieve for my coach at the time. Like, we've worked together. We used to work out together at Glasgow Life. So I'll give you an example. My dad died on the Tuesday, I think 7 o'clock in the morning. But at 8 o'clock, I was in the Emirates office. And no one in the office, apart from my boss, Brian, mm-hmm. my dad had died. He's like, what the fuck are you doing here? And I was like, I need to just keep going. I need to keep going. And it's that focus and that drive. It's like, I need to keep going because I can't focus on what's just happened. Because if I do, I'll be in tears. And I didn't do that for 3-4 months. I didn't properly grieve. And when my coach died, I didn't face it head on.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually went to go see a psychologist after it. And it was the biggest relief I'd ever done. And I was a typical man. I didn't like speaking about my feelings. I always took other people's problems on. I didn't need to give you my problems. And the first thing, I remember she said to me, she's like, I'm Zara, why are you here? And she said to me, why are you here? And I was like, I sat there for half an hour and I was in floods of tears by the end of it. And I needed it. And now looking back at me 7-8 years ago, it's about understanding that men especially bottle up their feelings mm-hmm. and about actually speaking out those feelings and having that paper to speak about. So although you can say I was mentally strong, I was probably mentally too strong because I wasn't confident enough to admit weakness and admit mm-hmm. because I thought as an athlete you can't be weak, you've got to be strong, you've got to, you know, we use the classic phrase man up. Well, you don't need to man up, there's no greater thing that you can do is speak about your feelings. Mm-hmm. So if my only criticism of myself when I was 8 years ago is probably I was too mentally strong, I was too mentally naive to think I could deal with those things that I couldn't, and it showed itself when it came to 2014 and 2018. And I think I can kind of relate to this in Celtic a wee bit. You look at, let's take Shane Duffy for example. His one wish that his old man wanted was what? To play for Celtic, mm-hmm. right? So he's done exactly what his old man wanted him to do, and he plays the game through emotion. You can't do that in elite sport. You've mm-hmm. got to play through the game through facts, figures, and results, not through emotion. When you put emotion in it, you've added another variable that's going to upset the apple cart. So that's why I've got a lot of sympathy with some people in sport, especially that. And I'm always a bit more mindful about what I say in sport and what I say on social media about people, because I realise I've had it myself. I've had people, I had a call, somebody had a column in the, I think it was the Telegraph for the Daily Mail, and they were absolutely slagging me for the way I looked because they said I had 4 pizzas for breakfast. And I'm just like, you know what, I don't need that. And I know how I felt about the day, so I'm always a bit more mindful about what I say about people as well. So it gives me that flip side of it.
See, that just shows you as well, Robert, doesn't it, that there's a lot of things these days can be about men's mental health. And I don't think people maybe, and normal guys, maybe obviously Chris is normal, but he's an athlete. But for me and you, they might tell you to talk about it, but they don't really mention athletes a lot in this thing. I think now they're starting to mention men and athletes a bit more, but I still don't think enough's been done, because as Chris says, most of the time you walk into your work and you're like, I'm fine, but sometimes you're like, you feel like saying I'm no fine, but as Chris says, you feel if you say something, somebody's going to say, man up. And I think that's in general, no, just normal life. But I think maybe now it's starting to creep in a bit better, more information about it. But I think in the kind of elite sport bubble, it doesn't really get the attention it deserves, Robert.
No, Ryan, it's like, Chris, I'm really sorry to hear about your dad and your coach. Just recently, 3 years ago, I lost my dad and my sister within 3 months of each other. And just what you're saying on grief, I've never had time to grieve because I had 2 young nieces at the time through my sister, and my dad passing was 13 and 16 and I had my mum. So all I ever focused on was making sure they were all right. And I don't think I've ever really grieved. I, of course, I understand that. But I've never really had time to grieve because I've always had to focus on looking after somebody else or being there for somebody else. And just to hear your stories, it brought back a lot of memories of how I felt at the time and still do to this day. And every day in life I try and focus on to impress them and make sure that they're looking down wherever they may be in this earth or heaven or whatever you like to call it, and try and make them proud and do the things and try and be a father figure to my nieces and help my mum as much as I can. And just to hear your story is just brings back a lot of memories, Chris. Thanks for that, just because it does give you a wee thought back to your own life and very similar stories, but different in other ways.
I mean, I think I would always try and I was a bit like you, and I was always trying to impress him. My one big wish was for my dad to see me at the Commonwealth Games, and that never happened. Mm-hmm. That never ever happened. He never got to see me compete on the big stage, and that was a big. I felt wrong that didn't happen. I was like, why did that not happen? And I was very angry it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But I've got to admit that I can't change that now. I've got the memories of that. He was proud of me, and I was the apple of his eye, and I can't change that. Like, I can't change what I've had in the past. I can be thankful that for the time that I've had, and thankful for the influence he had on my life. And yeah, you never forget them, but it gets a little bit easier as it goes on. And I learned to let go of that side of me, of being angry about that I didn't get to do this and I didn't get to do that. You get on, and when you take emotion out of it, and it was really hard for me because I thrive on emotion. I thrive on that underdog status of people not believing in me, and or people telling me I can't do something, and I want to prove them wrong, and I want to hear that, see the emotion when they come round, and I do what they want. But that, again, when you start competing about emotion, you can use it as a driving force, but at the end of the day, you've got to want to better yourself as well at the end of the day. And that was the big thing for me. And actually grieving was a massive release for me, because I was doing things for other people. I needed to do it for myself. And I was always doing that through my career in sport. I was too busy doing it for other people. And I realised, do I actually want to do this? And that was a big turning point for me, especially as well.
Besides, Robert, even yourself, Robert, you mentioned that. I didn't know that happened as well, mate, so I'm sorry for that as well. But it's actually quite... I'm happy you spoke with that, guys, because it is quite... I'm actually quite... I'm not laughing. It's hearing the connection. I'm connecting with you. Some people haven't had people pass away, so some people don't know what it's like. And I'm not going to mention who passed away. People have either passed away, and I've had mental health issues myself through football injuries, and it all comes into the same bracket, people dying, injuries, and your mind only really is, Chris, you say, your mind only really sets free when you start maybe grieving through it, and maybe when you see something, because I've seen something myself, I've had that depression, it's not all people know about it, but it's just things like that, and when me and Noah playing football, it gave me a back step, it took me away from when I'm here, I'm not playing football, what am I going to do? And that's maybe how maybe you felt when no danger sport.
But this is the thing, it's like the three of us, right, we've never met in the same room. We're having this Zoom conversation now, right? I've spoke about something about grief, right? I've just met Robert. But Robert's felt comfortable enough to tell me that, right? So the way I liked it, we spoke about this at the start, and you said to me, if you don't want to speak about anything, have it off. I'm like, no, it's important that we speak about it, because the more people that speak about it normalises it, and it takes the stigma away from men's mental health and men's body image and men's things like that. And that's the most important thing here. Like, if I'm comfortable speaking about it and I can use my platform, I don't have a big platform, but when I do have a platform, I like to think I can make a difference and not have other people think down on me, or other people think, oh, he's just trying to make himself look better. For me, I'm always like, if having the conversation with someone makes one person talk about their mental health, stop themselves from ever committing suicide, stop themselves from, you know, having an eating disorder, then that's a worthwhile conversation, and that's done more good than anything can ever do. And that's the important thing. So I think the most important thing that we've done is we've had a conversation, and the three of us, I know you, Ryan, through work, and I've only just met Robert, but we feel comfortable enough to have that conversation. And the more conversations are had, the less it's stigmatised, and the more people can open up about it, and the more people can actually normalise it and realise, oh, it's not just me that's got these thoughts, other people have these thoughts, because we all do. I've coached athletes that have had eating disorders, have had mental health problems, and I'm just like, look, you're not strange, you're not different to anyone else. Everybody has this. And if more sports people can talk about it, and more sports people can normalise it. It's like sexuality in sport, and especially men's football. Now, you look at it, there was a stat, and I'll feel free to be corrected about it, that 1 in 10 people are gay. Mm-hmm. But why is there no gay footballers? Because it's still stigmatised. It's going to be that domino effect. You have one footballer coming out, and I would be willing to bet my house on this, that there are gay footballers out there just now playing football.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the sooner we normalise that, you know what, people are gay, get over it. Like, so what? Who cares? Like, to me, they're just a normal person. They're a human being. I don't care if they're gay, they're black, they're white, they're Asian, they're, you know, what they do. I value them as a human being, and that's what we need to do in life. And whether they have a mental health struggles, whether they have eating disorders, whether it's sexuality issues, who cares? They're a person, and that's what counts the most.
No, I think we've all been brought up on judging people. That's how, as a society, we need to change and get in with the 21st century. She says, if the guy's gay or the woman's gay, they're gay. What's that got to do with what they perform on a part and what they do in their private life? It's nothing to do with any of us.
Exactly,
Chris. I agree with you on that.
It's a gay, Chris. I totally agree with you. These things maybe don't get spoken about enough. But if anybody who listens to the podcast when it's released, if we can help anybody, anybody who can think back and they've been through it and they go, oh, that kind of, I remember that to myself, and they revert back to it. And as he says, if it makes somebody have a bit of peace or maybe go and get help, then it's a bit of a brilliant thing, because not a lot of people do actually say, I need help, or I'm gay, or this. Nobody, because like he says, it is a bit of a stigma, especially when you're in the limelight, and because you know yourself, Robert and Chris, when you're a football player, you've got to look the part, you've got to have your haircut all the time, you've got to look good. Now, even you see football players in the park, they're not even sweating, their hair's brilliant, and they're more a model, an icon now than they are football players. Like Ronaldo, he's a football player, but he's a brand now, he's not a football player, he's a brand. But I think in general, I'd agree with you, he's that things maybe need to be highlighted a bit more. But obviously yourself, Chris, you mentioned the Commonwealth Games, and obviously at the Olympics. How is he getting called up for them? That must have been some feeling. And how do you actually get called up for that? Is it a process, or is it times, or do you need to do qualifying events for it?
So you have to do qualifying distances. So Glasgow and Gold Coast was a little bit different to Rio, because I kind of knew I was going to them for 2 years out. So I knew 2012 I was going to Glasgow, and I knew in 2016, 2017 I was going to Gold Coast. So they were a lot easier to deal with. So basically what's happened is there's a selection criteria put out probably two and a half years beforehand about a set distance that you need to throw in a set time period. So it can maybe be, so for instance, Birmingham qualification, which is the next Commonwealth Games in 2022, started on March the 1st. So between March the 1st and the middle of June next year, I have to do a set distance once in that period, and then that nominates me for selection. Now, that's not a guaranteed selection. That just nominates me for selection. So that allows me to be discussed at the selection meeting. So then off the back of, especially for Commonwealth Games, it goes in your ranking. So where you are ranked, your previous history, your age. So there's a whole load of factors in it. But generally, if you hit a standard for Commonwealth Games, you'll more than likely go. So Olympics was a little bit different for me, because there was two ways I could qualify. So I could qualify on my world ranking, or I could qualify on my the distance that I threw. So I didn't throw the distance, but I was qualified high enough up in the world rankings that I would get an invite. So I was ranked 16th in the world in 2016. But British Athletics, who are the people who select you, who nominate you to the British Olympic Association, had spent the whole year saying, we will not select you on an invite. You have to throw the set distance. So I was fine with that. I didn't have an issue. It was very clear, and that was told to me from 2015. So I knew what I had to do. So I'm always one of these people that if I know what I've got to do and they've told me what I've got to do and I don't do it and don't get selected, I can't complain and I can't moan and grumble about it. So I went to Amsterdam for the European champs. I'd been selected for that. I just won the British Olympic trials, just won British championships. So I was kind of in the views on what they were going to select. And I was told the qualifying was on the Friday for the final, which was on the Sunday. And I was told on the Wednesday, actually, we had an informal discussion. It was like, look, if you make final at European champs, you'll go to Rio. And I'm like, okay, I know what I need to do. So I turned up on the Friday, finished fifth in qualified for the final, and I'm like, right, I've never been to major championships before, and I've suddenly made a final at European champs. So that was always in the back of my mind about going to Rio, and I'd kind of had my heart set that I wasn't going. So selection meeting was the Monday, the phone calls were made on the Tuesday. So I got a phone call. I was sitting at Linwood just before training. I got a phone call, and it was a guy, Peter Stanley, and I totally expected him to say, you're not going. So I said, "Hi Peter, how's it going?" I take it this is the phone call. The thing, he says, "I'm obviously not going." And he said, "Nah, you better clear your diary." He says, "You're going to Rio." And I'm like, "Oh fuck! I've got my mate's wedding. I've got his stag do. I've got everything else planned. I've got my holidays planned and everything." And it's like, "Oh fuck! I need to clear my diary for the Olympics." And it's a bit of a whirlwind because you get this was on the Tuesday. I got the phone call, and then on the Wednesday I had to go down to Birmingham for my kitting out process, which was 6 hours. And you get 92 kilos worth of kit for going to the Olympics. So you get everything you can ever think of. Three-piece suit, training gear, competition gear, new trainers, Panasonic give you headphones, Beat give you headphones, Samsung give you a new phone. So it was all very, very different to me. But, I didn't really understand the process. And when I got to it, kind of was in that imposter syndrome, didn't really know what I was doing there. Kind of had finished my season, hadn't really planned for it, so really struggled with that. But yeah, they're two very, very different processes. One, Commonwealth Games, I was expected to go to. Olympics, I wasn't expected to go to, so it was a big shock. But I've kind of overachieved in sport and went way beyond my dreams. So I'm hoping to kind of go and get new dreams and go further now.
Just even to be at a Commonwealth Games in the Olympics, it must have been, as you say, it's maybe the pinnacle of an athlete. Maybe get to Olympics. I don't know much about athletics, kids, but I know they're major competitions, and I think to get to that, it must be, as you say, maybe something that you've dreamed for a long time, and you're saying you're overachieved, but maybe you're just really good at your sport, Chris, and you've got your own merit. So I take my hat off you because you've obviously worked hard for it. And I think
this is the thing. It's like you look at it and you go, "There's only ever been 5,000 people from Great Britain have been to an Olympics." Now, we live in a country of 60-odd million people. Now, that is a really, really small percentage of the country has been to it. But there were two very, very different competitions. So being from Glasgow, being a Celtic fan, getting to walk out of Celtic Park for the opening ceremony was fucking mental. It was unbelievable. Going to Rio, where you go to the favelas, and there's maybe like 100 people in the stands, it's like it didn't feel the Olympics. It didn't feel like the Olympics. There was 100 people. Maybe I'm underestimating quite a bit, but the stadium was half empty when we were competing. When you turn up at Hampden, there's 45,000 there, and they're clapping warm-up throws, and you're just like, they have no clue what's going on, but they're just happy to be here. Mm-hmm. And it was mental. It was like, it didn't feel the Olympics, and that didn't really help me. But it's the pinnacle of our sports career. It's like the equivalent of a footballer going to a World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
It's like not many, especially in Scotland as well. You look at people, how many great footballers have we had in Scotland that haven't qualified for a major tournament? And I've equivalently done that at the Olympics. So, yeah, it's quite special. And when I look back, and I've got the vest obviously behind me, but when I look back in 10, 15 years' time, I think I'll appreciate it more. And rather than, I should have lived in the moment a wee bit and took a wee bit of time when I was out there and just appreciated it.
No, but I don't know, but it's very, obviously, Chris is saying you overachieved, but to have the experiences in sport, it is a big story to tell, because as Chris just mentioned there, it's not something that happens every day to a Scottish or a British Olympic athlete.
No, it's an incredible story. I'm really intrigued by listening to Chris. I think it's really, really, I'm just sitting here like somebody in the crowd just listening, and it's brilliant just to hear a different sport that I don't know too much about. I watch some Olympics. I watched Glasgow Commonwealth Games, and I thought it was amazing just to see everybody at Celtic Park lit up. And it just, as Chris says, it wasn't a dream come true to him was to play at Celtic Park, probably as a young boy, but to go and represent your country at Celtic Park is probably the next best thing. And it's incredible. His stories are brilliant just to sit and listen to, and Rio must have been incredible being in Brazil. It's just where these jokes took him and the thing he loves.
It's the only place where the rich and the poor live side by side. Like you as an athlete, you're fortunate enough to see the really, really nice places. But the beauty of Brazil was you actually got to see the real Brazil. You drove past the favelas. Like, for instance, they gave us, we got a security briefing after we'd competed, because basically athletes are normal human beings. When we finish what we're doing, we'll go to a party, we'll go have a couple of beers, we'll be normal once you've finished competing, not before you do your job. This was my big bugbear at Celtic, I spoke about earlier on. But they said to us, they said, don't go to Copacabana Beach. There was 400 sexual assaults last week at Copacabana Beach. and that's men, women, and children. And you're like, holy shit. And then they said, oh, by the way, a rate of crime in Brazil that's actually reported is only 30%. They went, so do the maths on how many there actually was. And I'm like, shit. So they said, don't go into the favelas. The police drove into the favelas last night and got shot. So if they're shooting at the police, what the hell are they going to do to you? Like a random stranger. And it was just, it opened my eyes. But that was the beauty of the country. You got to see the real Brazil. You didn't see the Brazil that was glossed up, because like it was evident in Glasgow as well. Look how good Glasgow looked for the Commonwealth Games. Now, was that a true reflection of what Glasgow is like on a day-to-day basis? No, because we want to show the good parts. So it was nice to actually see the proper parts of Brazil as well. And as an athlete, we don't see that often enough. We don't get to see what the real country is like. You spend your time at either a hotel, the athlete village, or an airport in the stadium, and that's all you get to see. So for us, it was really nice to see the proper side of it as well, and the real eye-opener on what the poverty is like. And you look back at Brazil now, and a lot of the venues aren't used anymore. I went to the Maracanã, for instance, for the closing ceremony, which held the World Cup final 2 years previous, and then the next year it's got empty seats. People are nicking in the seats. So it's just a whole different ballgame and a whole different experience, but one that I'm very thankful that I got to experience.
See how you're talking about, obviously, the Commonwealth Games, Olympics, going abroad, travelling. That's, for me, something that I've always dreamed of living abroad. I just love going away and seeing new people, seeing new things, loving the sun, obviously the sunshine. But see, travelling, that must be amazing. Just as you say, you're travelling everywhere, you're seeing different places, different people, different nightclubs, just a total different outlook in life. And it must make you as well, Chris, maybe more, I'm not saying motivated, but I bet me a mother to actually keep doing and keep travelling and basically enjoying the sport and enjoying the life.
Well, that's the thing. I'm in a very privileged position. I get to travel to different countries to compete, to see different parts of the world, and I don't have to pay for it. It's my job. Mm-hmm. I get to do it doing something I love. I'm very, very fortunate, and this is where I got back to saying it. But at the start of the pandemic, I couldn't moan because I'd lived a very privileged life up till I was 30. I didn't really have to work full-time. I got to train full-time. I got to go and enjoy things. I got to travel the UK, do my school visits. I got to go to Australia for 6 weeks for Commonwealth Games. I got to take my mum with me. She got the trip of a lifetime. So I'm very fortunate for the opportunities that I've been given. And I said it, and I was doing it at the City Chambers. I'm just a kid for a council house that got mm-hmm. lucky. And that's what it is. It's like, I like to think that if I can do it, and it's more my attitude as well, that there's always a way to do something. And my mum's got this phrase that we always use, we've never died a winter yet, because you always, and there has been struggles, there's been times where I've not had enough money, there's been times where I've had debts that I couldn't pay, or I couldn't have paid credit card bills, but do you know what? I've got through it the other side, and I've enjoyed it, and I've led a really good life up until now. So if someone was to say that's it stopped, I couldn't really complain. I'd go find another job, and I'd be upset, yeah, but I've had a good run at it, and I'm very thankful for it, and I'm very aware of it now more than ever that it can be taken away from you just like that. So I'm more thankful for what I appreciate now, and I want to get back to the different countries. This is probably the longest I've been at home. Like, I've only had 2 nights away from home in the past year. Usually during the summer I'm away the whole time, and that's the great experience of it as well. But hopefully we can get back to a little bit more normality soon.
Because I know, Robert, it's what Chris is saying, how he's been all privileged, and he's been travelling and obviously living in kind of good accommodation, getting away and stuff. It's just, but the fact that he's very grounded. He's still about his home life. He knows when he comes back, just normal Chris. But he is a normal guy. I think that's the people need to remember, Robert, is that even football players, as soon as they leave that Twingon or they leave that stadium, they're still a human being, they're still normal guys. I don't think, people might think, they see Chris defeat as an athlete, he's not going to talk to me, football player, not going to talk to me, but people need to realise that they are human beings and they have feelings, they're the same people, just like me and you. Just because that's their job, it doesn't mean that they're not the same as us.
It's brilliant just to hear that Chris is saying what up in a council estate, and he had a, when they say, support him and get him to where he is. And I feel the stories are always better than a kid that's probably been given everything and they make it. And you know what I mean? They've always had Like, you hear about some at youth level, and I've heard stories about they keep them on it, quote, up to the kids, probably get kept on, and some good kids for housing schemes and stuff get let go. I'm not saying that happens all the time, but I've heard some kind of stories on their lines, and it's just like either me and you, Ryan, coming for a housing scheme and going and doing well, and just to hear Chris's story, it's like a dream come true. It's like a best-selling book with a happy ending. You know what I mean? It's great to hear. And your country. Sorry, Chris.
I guess I'm very fortunate where I've got mates that keep me grounded, though. So I've got five or six people that I would call my very good mates, and we have a long outstanding joke that I'm actually unemployed. They're like, you don't have a job, you're unemployed, you just sit at the home all day and go to the gym and do a bit of training. But that's what keeps me grounded at the end of the day. I don't think footballers and athletes have that in their life. Mm-hmm. People that keep them grounded, because we blow smoke up their ass all the time, and I hate people that blow smoke up my ass. I hate people that congratulate me things. I hate people that are just like, oh, you're great, you're this, you're that, and I'm just like, no, I'm just me, and I do my sport, and I'm good at it, and that doesn't make me better than anyone else, and it shouldn't make you better than anyone else. So I'm good at my job, which just so happens to be sport. Does that make me any better than an electrician that's good at his job, or a plumber that's good at his job, or a school teacher that's good at their job? No. Does it make me any better? Just because I'm good at sport, just because I've been on the TV, just because I've got a blue tick on Twitter, does not make me better than any other human being. And it goes back to that thing where, at the end of the day, we're all human beings. But we shouldn't be seen as what we're, a sportsman, an athlete, a school teacher, a PE teacher, a basketball player, anything like that. You're a human being at the end of the day, and we don't do that enough. We need to treat people as human beings, not he's a dick, I'm a dick, all that sort of malarkey, you know what I mean? And social media doesn't help that. Social media doesn't help that, but that's a whole different podcast.
Aye, definitely. Social media is totally, especially these days, a lot of things are happening. But so obviously you said you went a lot on obviously nights out and stuff like that. Chris, have you any kind of funny stories for nights out, or just in general, favouring in amongst different athletes? And if there any other athletes that we maybe know that you've been maybe compete against, or kind of, or you're still kind of pals with in the moment?
I cannot. We've had the nights out after the commie games and the Olympics are always the best ones.
I can see your face is a bit entertaining.
Probably the best one I had was Rio, where they didn't really want us going out of the Olympic Village because they said it wasn't safe. So you know the big lazy spa hot tubs you get? So they were using them as ice baths for the whole period of time. But on the last night, they emptied out the ice out of them and filled them all with beer. So we were playing beer pong on there. We absolutely demolished this hot tub, and we're like, you know what? They can't do it again. They ended up filling it up again. Now, bearing in mind that we didn't stop drinking until 7 o'clock in the morning, and we had to be out of our rooms by 8 o'clock the next night. So I hadn't slept that much. We were flying home that night, and I wanted to get a good sleep on the flight home. I thought, do you know what? We'll take a wee sleeping tablet, right? So took a sleeping tablet. No, this isn't working. So I took another one, which I shouldn't have done. I thought, I'll take another one. I'll be fine. No, it wasn't happening. So my mate had diazepam for his back, so I took another one, and that was it. I don't remember taking off, and I woke up and I was fucking slab on the way of me. 4 hours into the flight, I didn't know where I was. I was like, fuck, do you know when you ever woke up after a night and you're like, oh, fuck, am I? Why am I doing it? Like at somebody's random house? I took the last night. So I says, where are we? She's like, we're 4 hours into the flight. So I went up, had a pee, had a 7-up, went back to bed, and I slept the whole 13-hour flight, and it completely fucked me up. But it was unbelievable that night. But after Gold Coast, I went on a week-long bender. It was just a week-long bender, because I wasn't happy with how I competed, so I was still hiding away from the fact. And it was, I remember the closing ceremony in Gold Coast was the same night as we played the Rangers in the semi-final at Hampden, and we won them 4-0. Beat them 4-0, sorry. So I ended up going out with the BBC boys to watch the game. And full kilt, like full closing ceremony gear, standing about, like it was like Tom English and I mean Dougie that works for the BBC. It was just one of those surreal experiences. But you probably wouldn't know any of the athletes that I've competed against, but I do a bit of work with the Great Run. I do a lot of driving for them. So before I went to Olympics, I had to take Mo Farah back to the airport, and I had a video that went viral with Mo Farah of me and him singing Stormzy in the car on the way to the airport. And Stormzy shared it on his Instagram and his Twitter. So I'm getting all these messages saying, oh, there's Mo's fat roadman, there's Mo's white roadman. And it's just like, I'm not ready for this. Like, I just turned this off. So I was getting a bit abused for that. But you get some good stories and you see the other side of people, and they're just normal human beings. It's just like letting their hair down. Do you know what I mean? And that's what it's about at the end of the day. The nights out are often the funniest part of it, but the competing side is the most important thing. And that was my big bugbear, especially in Celtic and Dubai. They did the drinking first and then the hard work after it. We should be the hard work first and then have a day off after that. That's the thing.
Have you ever been starstruck, Chris, and any celebrities or sports persons that you've met?
Usain Bolt was probably the one I was starstruck by the most. So he was walking past me in the Olympic Village and I was kind of like, oh shit, there's Bolt. Like, because like everybody stays in the Olympic Village. Like every athlete stays in the Olympic Village. So we had obviously had Andy Murray on the team. We had Jamie Murray. We had like Danny Willett. So the first morning I got to Rio, I had breakfast with the doctor. Doctor, it was head of medical for BOA. So we sat there. I had to mind if I sat, you know, anyway. So there's a guy sitting next to Niall, our doctor, sitting chatting away. And I was like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, I had no idea who it was. It was Danny Willett that just won the Masters. And I'm just like, why is he sitting at a table with me having breakfast? And I struggled to get on that level. Mm-hmm. And like Andy Murray was staying in the in our accommodation, just normal, a little room with a bed, no airs or graces. The only people that didn't stay in the village were the American basketball team, right? Who hired their own cruise ship and put it in the harbour at Rio. Which is different level. But like the Olympic Village is one of these things, and it becomes normal once you've been to a couple of villages. You understand that there are just people walking about. Bolt was the one I was just like, oh man, because he had his own personalised headphones with a world record on the side, he's still Puma gear, and you just stop. And even the athletes at the warm-up track were sitting watching him warm up. And I remember watched these three races in Rio, and it was mental. Winning like one Olympic gold is amazing, but that guy won 9 Olympic golds. And you just think, we'll never ever see that again. So that's probably the one person I've been starstruck by. But like growing up, it was Henrik Larsson always starstruck me. Like, I just loved Henrik Larsson. That was the one that I wanted to be. I wanted the deadlocks. I wanted to be able to stick my tongue out when I scored. And like growing up, I wanted to play up front and score up front with Henrik Larsson. So like no one will ever beat meeting Henrik Larsson in my life. That's just the one moment that topped it for me. So yeah, probably Larsson and Bolt are the two people I've been starstruck by.
That's actually quite good company.
A funny story. I was only a young apprentice, paint and decorate. That's what I do, Chris, as a job. And we were working at Hamilton's Park, and they were building a nursery under the main stand. So every Monday at 2 o'clock, without fail, Henrik Larsson would turn up and go in and see the physio. So when I got on the job, guy was a Rangers fan, he says to me, 2 o'clock, out there, Henrik Larsson would turn up. I says, so he fucking will, and pigs can fly. He went, right, I'll take you out at 2 o'clock, and we'll guarantee you. Takes me at 2 o'clock, watch this, big Mercedes pulls into the drive, into the car park, out climbs Henrik Larsson. He says, told you. So I'm running about with a headless chicken man with paint dripping off my ears with a bit of pen and paper. Henrik Larsson, Henrik, can you sign that? So I, Henrik comes there, signs it, cracking. Guy says, hey, I've got a birthday card for a young boy, it's going to be his 18th. Can you sign that, Henrik? He says, I ain't bother. He says, if you just sign there on the dotted line, that's you signing for Rangers. And he went, haha, no chance, and signed it. Got the card and said, see you later. And every Monday, he went into Hamilton's training, Hamilton's Park, and seen the physio at 2 o'clock every Monday.
There's a good thing based out of Hamilton.
I was saying, why is that wee painter guy keep turning up and looking at me out of my car? I was starstruck again at your rock.
That's crazy, isn't it? That's still somebody you'd expect to turn up with your work, isn't it? It's last outside, you know what I mean? But I like Chris, that's like you say with Usain Bolt and Larsson. It's even for me, if I've seen these guys, I'm like, whoa, obviously Larsson, you've seen him playing, but Bolt, as you say, is how quick he was. Like, see, obviously, we watch it, is it quicker actually watching it than it is on the telly? Is it just total a flash of lightning?
It's quick. It is quick. Like, I think it's, athletics is one of these sports that you can underappreciate by the camera angles until you actually see it in person and you see someone running 100 metres in under 10 seconds, right? Under 10 seconds is world class. When you see someone run it in 9.5 seconds, you're like, ah, shit, that's that. And you, like, you see it as well. Like, how many people do you know in school? Like, oh, I used to be a runner. I used to play football. I used to do this. I used to do that. And then you put them up on side and you put them up on side someone and you think, that would be you running against Usain Bolt and you're at 50 metres and he's finished. That's the comparison. Like, when you see it done in person, is one of those things that you just can't appreciate to yourself. It's like you see someone throwing a javelin the length of a football field. People are like, holy fuck, that is massive. And you tell them it only weighs 800 grams and then you see you throw it and they throw it 10 metres and somebody else is throwing it 90 metres. Yeah. Like, it's underappreciated as a sport and it gives you that sense of appreciation. And I think that was one good thing that when I still worked with Great Run, and they took the Great City Games and they had it in Manchester. So the first year they had it, they had Usain Bolt running down the main street in Manchester. And it gave people that first chance to actually see sport live in the flesh, running down Deansgate. And people just couldn't comprehend it. And it's a whole different way of life for those people as well. It makes you appreciate it more when you see it in person. You see it done well.
It's something I've never actually seen as a live athletics. It's probably something I'd like to see, because even just speaking to you now, I'd like to see it live, because watching it on the telly, you're like, well, that's amazing. But actually watching it in person, it's the same with a football game. You watch it on the telly, yeah, that atmosphere looks good, he looks good, but then when you go and see somebody, even like, from, I don't know what Robert's opinion on it is, but when we see guys like Edward, Scott Brown at his peak, you're thinking, fuck, these guys are fucking really, really good. But then when they go and play against the top players, you're like, fuck's sake, they're not really any. But when you go to these games, because I've always had, see, since the game against PSG when they beat us 5-1 at home, right? The guy Rabiot, Verratti and Cavani were unbelievable. I've never seen guys like that play football. But for me, as a striker, when I play football as a striker, see, just watching Cavani, his movement is, but you need to be in the flesh to see that and actually take in the game. Guys just turn up and watch Celtic won't take in that. They won't see that experience. And it shows you how it is. Like, maybe obviously yourself, you're at the top level of your sport. For them, Cavani, Rabu, Verratti, to get to that level, compared to Scott Brown and the guys like Edward, you're like, wait a minute, that's different gravy.
The one that I first noticed it with was when Pirlo played for Juventus and they beat us 3-0 at home, the guy stood in front of the 18-yard box pretty much the whole game and dictated everything that went on. He was playing passes left, right and centre, putting them on sixpences, and you're just like, holy fuck, how can you... Like, we would have seen like Ledley at that time, Ledley, Kyle, Brown would have been in the team, and we'd appreciate that. Oh, they're amazing. When they come up against your St. John's and your St. Mary's, that's what they look like. But you take it up that level and you see it in the flesh, you're like, oh, it was like Balotelli was another one. I see Balotelli at Parkhead. He was unbelievable. Like, and this is a guy who you would not consider as a genuinely top of their game, world class. It's just that different level. So, and that night sticks with the PSG night sticks with me quite a lot, because there was a moment kind of midway through the first half where they played out their box and Celtic were pressing them hard in the box, and it was Silva, Marquinhos, and I think it was Kazawa that was playing left back, and the three of them were just playing wee 5-yard passes, and it was like 40 seconds they were in the box. Next minute they're up the park and they score, and that's just the different levels, and you get to appreciate that more and more when you start to watch sport.
I don't know, but that's a game, I know I've said it on here before, that I know we get beat, but for a football fan, and a guy that loves football, and now because obviously I'm not playing football anymore, I'm watching games for a kind of coaching perspective now, you do appreciate, as much as we don't want to get beat heavily in these games, you kind of partly are going to see these guys play, because you might never see them again. Guys like your name, people might slaughter name already, but the guys world class. I appreciate you seeing these guys, even at Celtic Park, to see these guys at that level close up. It is really what football is all about.
There's ones that have stood out, obviously, your main names, but there's a boy that played with Borussia Mönchengladbach, when they beat us 2-0 at Celtic Park in the middle of the park. And he really impressed me, because I get you've got your Kakas, your Rabiots, your Pirlos, early years, fantastic players, but you expect it after them, if you get me. The boys Stendo in the middle of the park for Borussia Mönchengladbach, I knew he was a good player, but I didn't realise how good he was. And he dictated that game when they beat us 2-0 at Celtic Park. And I thought, wow, he's really, really good. He's better than I thought. And I can't remember the name of the boy for Valencia that played in the middle of the park. He was another one. Danny knew he was Parejo. A good player. What was his name, Chris?
Parejo.
Mm-hmm.
Parejo, whatever the boy's name. And they're two boys that I knew were good players, but when I seen them in the flesh, they were really good. They were better than I ever really. Now, you know, they play with good teams, you know they're good players, but I expect to have Pirlo, Kaká and stuff, and that's two guys at good teams, but I didn't realise how good they were and how they moved the ball with so much ease. And they say, I'm not saying they're as good as Kaká and Pirlo and that, but they reminded me of so much of them, and it just shows you how talented these guys really are. Because you think we've got a chance against teams like that till you see that type of player and you go, wow, they should be playing at a better level. In my eyes, that's when you look at them, you go, they're really, really good. You know what I mean? That was just two that very stood out to me that I didn't know much really about till I seen them kind of close up and how good they actually were.
It's as Chris says, it's yeah, they appreciate them, Robert, the guys, as much as you want to win the game. But if you beat and you've seen the guys play football, part of you are like, I've just seen world class players there. Obviously, I'm not happy with teams get beat, but it's very hard for Celtic to can beat at that level. I know other teams like Leipzig and Salzburg have done it, but we've got to be kind of realistic. Some fans need to be realistic that we just need to try and compete when we can. But obviously, Chris, as you've mentioned, amazing career with athletics. Obviously, a big Celtic fan. Growing up, was there any kind of memorable games that you can remember? And obviously, who was your idol growing up as a Celtic fan?
My first game, we got beat in the Cup semi-final at Ibrox. I think, I'm sure it was it Raith Rovers in the Cup 95 we get beat? Somebody okay.
94-95 we get beat after Raith Rovers in the final.
In the final, was it the semi-final at Ibrox?
Final, that was the final.
Well, there you go. That was my
you get beaten penalties, Paul McStay missed the penalty.
That was my first game, and we kind of sporadically went to games after that. But like my first proper memory of a game at Celtic Park was the game we stopped the 10, and quite ironic that we're speaking about this now. So, that was kind of my first proper memory of being at Celtic Park. After that, we got a season ticket, but then I've said this before, I was really interested in the football. My mum just took me to keep me busy, more interested in the food at half time, and I was always concerned about getting my hot dog at half time, so I was really concerned with the football. And then we didn't have a lot of money growing up, so it was my mum was like, well, if you're not going to football, I mean, you're not going to watch your football, then we're not going, that's it, we'll keep up the books. So we gave up the books, and it's now the standing section. We sat just above where the standing section is, and then I'd go to the odd game here and there when I had time, but it was 2016 it was when I got my season book again, and I decided that year, I said, I've got a bit of money, I was like, do you know what, I'm going to get a season ticket, and I thought we were going to get David Moyes in as the manager, and I thought, do you know what, he'll bring some good football, we'll do that, and I was quite happy with it, but we ended up getting Brendan Rodgers in, so I took my book, and I sit in FS6 in the main stand, and people can say, oh, it's posh, just sitting in the main stand. It's great. I'd happily do it. And I only go myself. I don't go with my mum. I don't go with my dad. My dad's leaving now, but he was nearly into football. I just go myself because I wanted the distraction away from sport. I needed that distraction. And it was quite funny. The first couple of times when I went, the boys all around me, and we're in a group chat with them now. They were just kind of, they were dead quiet, and they spoke a wee bit about it. And it was, we were playing Hapoel Beersheba in the qualifier, right? And the boys said to me, "Oh, are you coming next week to Beersheba again?" I was like, "No, I'm going to Rio." "How are you going to Rio for?" I said, "I'm going to Olympics." No worries. So I remember I was watching the Beersheba game in the village in Rio, and I came back to the next game, and they were like, "Oh, you really were at the Olympics then, weren't you?" And I went, "Aye, I'm not going to sit and turn around and bullshit you and say I was away to Rio just away to volunteer or whatnot or what." So it was quite funny. So I got a good relationship with that. And football was always a distraction for me. It's always just a case of I can go for 90 minutes, I can't influence the result, I can sit and watch it, and that's it. Like, you know, I go away, the result's done, I can't influence it. It was a good release for me. And I've been fortunate through other lines of work, but I've got to go away with Celtic in Europe. We organise, the company I work for organise away fan charters for the European game. So I get to work them, I get paid to go to them, paid to watch the game, and then up the road. So it's great. So last time I was away was Copenhagen away from home, but it was quite funny because the company I worked for got the contract and they said, we've got the contract for Celtic. And I was like, doing what? And they said, the European away games. I said, what are you doing? And they said, we're doing the fan travel. I was like, how'd I get to go? I was like, just bump me up the queue. I said, I'll pay as a punter, but just let me go. I just want to go just to experience that. He says, come work it for us. And I'm like, nah, any bother, cool. So this was 2 weeks before we went to Brussels. And they phoned me up a couple of days before it. He says, you still want to go to Brussels? I says, aye, I'll go. Right, Glasgow Airport, 4:30 in the morning. You'll get a ticket to the game. You'll get your £100 for going, all your expenses paid. And I'm like, I have not a fucking scoopy what I'm doing. I don't really know. You still there?
I still hear me, aye.
I think my phone's just run out of battery.
That's all right, mate. How's your way?
How's your way then? Just give me a minute to come back on.
But as I said, I don't know, but it's brilliant just hearing different stories for a different kind of sport for what we are obviously talking about in football. So just to hear his stories for going to the Olympics and everything else, it's brilliant to hear the, and as you said, it's refreshing to hear how he's working hard at that and then still living a normal life.
It's see when you think about it, Ryan, he's a guy for a housing scheme just like ourselves, and then he's in the middle of Rio in a village with Usain Bolt, the one of the most iconic guys in the world of athletes and world sport. Can you imagine just like being a wee guy for a housing scheme and being on the TV and getting to see Andy Murray, a guy that's won Wimbledon, and probably sitting just 5-6 seats away eating your breakfast for guys that you probably don't look up to, but you go, wow, they're the principal of sport and they're the top athletes, and a wee guy for housing schemes sitting next to them and having breakfast and competing at the same tournament, and people actually being fans of him and the radio and stuff like that. It must be, I've never been like that, but on yourself, but it must be a pure dream come true type of thing.
Oh, definitely, mate. It's a bit surreal, isn't it? When you mentioned Bolt and you mentioned all the guys who he's done well at sitting at the table. It's definitely things that obviously probably Chris wouldn't have imagined, and he's actually went and done it.
Aye, no, definitely. It's incredible, but it's one of the things, isn't it? It's great to hear these stories because it's probably stories that nobody else has ever heard before. So it's just great to hear. And I'm quite chilled sitting back listening to these stories because it's something I would have never known. Just like going to Rio, as he says, you can go out because the crime rate just outside where they're participating in is through the roof, and the police even under danger. I mean, that's something that watching on the TV, you would never know.
No, it's crazy when he talks about obviously the ins and outs of Rio and what happens in the good life and in the bad life, and just for him to kind of, he's probably experienced that and went, wait a minute here. It's a bit of a different territory. But again, it's just probably having guys of that own here. And as you say, I'm kind of just sitting here listening. It's actually good to listen to somebody that's telling you the experiences, because you kind of, as obviously when you speak about mental health stuff, you kind of connect to it and you're thinking, right, you're relaxed, you're listening to it, and you're thinking, it's brilliant just to listen to these guys.
Oh, definitely. As he says, he got to take his mum to Australia for 6 weeks and watch him competing in the Gold Coast. And it's just great to, as you say, just to hear these stories and to get paid to go and do that. I mean, you would, if somebody asked you to go and do that tomorrow, you'd be like, right, I'll go and do it. But he's getting paid to do it and he enjoys it. So it was good how he found his way into the Olympics, and hammer thrown through probably default of trying everything, and then some things are just meant to be, you know what I mean?
But as I say, well, eventually we'll get him back on, because I think he was about to talk about the Dubai stuff and obviously his feelings about this season, but again, we will get back on because I think he's very interested in coming back on and telling his story about Celtic more. But that's the episode with Chris Bennett, the hammer thrower, Olympian, shall I say, and Commonwealth Games. Me and Robert, we'll appreciate coming on. Robert, thanks for your time, mate, and it's been good to kind of hear some stories for yourself as well that I've not heard before. But again, it's just things we need to kind of hopefully, with the mental health side, we keep progressing with it. And again, Robert, I think it's something that hopefully gets spoken about even more, especially during this pandemic that's happening.
Definitely, Ryan. It's good to just hear Chris's stories, and I just feel I had to share mine at that particular time because it brought back memories of just how everybody in life was, and we're all affected by it. Mental health, deaths in families, COVID. It's just, for me, I feel now I'm mentally stronger through bad experiences in life.
Mm-hmm.
I feel every day is a learning day, and I just feel things like that, you can just try and improve yourself and get better as days go on. Aye, you have your tough days, but I always feel there's light at the end of every tunnel, and you've just got to strive. If anybody's suffering from mental health, just always remember, every day is a brand new day. It's a new start. It's like getting a start button every single day. Every day changes. No, every day is the same. You can be sad one day. You could have 20 good days. Just always remember the next day is always a new opportunity.
No, spot on, mate. Definitely. It's something I'll probably touch it on more as we go along in the weeks and months along, because it's something that I think needs to be highlighted. And like yourself and Chris, he's kind of been through it a wee bit yourself, so he's no people need to speak, and people need to kind of be a bit of help. I think people need to realise that. But again, Robert, I appreciate you and Chris and one mate, very, very touching some of the topics. But that's us this week in this episode. Again, Robert, thanks for your help, and Chris,
thanks
all, mate. Cheers, mate.
Bye, mate.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.